Welcome to Glam City. On Glam City, we speak to the hardworking people in Australia's galleries, libraries, archives, and museums. I'm Kira Lindsay. I'm a historian based at the Australian Centre of Public History at UTS. Today, I'm speaking with Paul Irish, who's a Sydney-based historian and archaeologist. Paul is the author of Hidden in Plain View, The Aboriginal People of Coastal Sydney, which explores the history of Aboriginal people in Sydney, their interactions with early colonists, and it makes the argument that Aboriginal people were always here, even if, historically speaking, they were often hidden in plain view. So, Paul, welcome and thanks heaps for coming along.
Oh, thanks for having me.
I love your book. I think I ate the whole thing whole on one day in a weekend, and I've covered it with post-it notes. I'd love you to tell the listeners a little bit more about this book, and if there was a kind of specific question that you had when you started to do the research.
Yeah, look, I think it sort of evolved over time, and really ultimately I tried to write this book as the kind of book I wished I'd had when I was growing up in Sydney, because like many people, and I don't have Aboriginal ancestry myself, but we're not made aware of this history where it's literally all around us, but we're just not aware that it's there. And I wanted to write something that was didn't assume people already had knowledge, or didn't kind of put them down for not having that knowledge or anything like that, but just tried to explain, you know, that a bit of that journey as well. In my case, I came to history actually via archaeology and studying archaeology at Sydney University. I was walking past the block every day on my way to archaeology lectures, and I was just completely disconnected from that idea of the Aboriginal past and the Aboriginal present. I just thought that I was studying something abstract, this archaeological past that was the real Aboriginal Australia, and didn't think at all about the people living at the block and what their background might be, their ancestry, their connection potentially to places I was studying. So that's a pretty common thing, I think. I mean, even for people who are not interested in the past, I think we kind of divide our view of Aboriginal Australia into something that's very much about authenticity. You know, we use shorthands like remote communities and urban communities as though that means something about their Aboriginality or their connection. And of course, like, different groups have different backgrounds and histories, but I think it's in our minds we're stuck in this mindset of what's authentic and what's not. And at the heart of that is the idea that Aboriginal people can't change without losing their Aboriginality, without losing their connection. And you can't look at a place like Sydney or anywhere in Australia over the last couple of centuries and see a people that are completely unchanged. But that doesn't mean that they're not Aboriginal. It doesn't mean they've lost connection. And I think that's one of the key reasons why that story's been hidden for so long. So I sort of inherited that mindset, and I started working as an archaeologist thinking I was the one digging up the past, the real past, but I was working with Aboriginal people. Often they were people not from Sydney, and that's where most of my work was. But I was really interested in their stories, their family stories of how, you know, their families, immediate families, but also their ancestors had lived and how they'd come to be in Sydney and things like that. And around the same time, I started to get to know Aboriginal people from the La Perouse community and realised that their connection had much deeper roots in Sydney itself. And I just found myself asking, well, why didn't I know this? The answer was that the information is actually there. It's certainly in the knowledge of community members themselves, and it's certainly scattered around in archives and newspapers and things like that. But it's not a story that has been kind of assembled and, I guess, assimilated into our way of considering history. You know, in cities particularly, we tend to think of cities as being non-Aboriginal places, and there's a growing body of work, you know, my own research included, that is just showing that that's completely not the case, and it's never been the case.
And there is, in colonial history, because I'm a kind of colonial historian, there was a general argument that Aboriginal people were moved out of Sydney by the 1840s, but you've been able to show with this book that that's not the case at all, that there were people coming in and going, and there were kind of trade routes, if you like, that people were using, coastal Aboriginal groups were using to move in and out of Sydney on a regular basis. others.
Yeah, I think part of that idea of authenticity is definitely there. So the invisibility is partly because by the 1830s, 1840s, there's not a lot of Aboriginal people living in Sydney who were born before Europeans arrived and were considered to be, you know, completely traditional people in whatever that means. And there's a growing number of people with mixed ancestry as well, and they were often not seen as Aboriginal. And then the third thing, which you alluded to as well, is the movement of people. You know, they weren't just from Sydney. They had connections in a few different places. But if they were seen to come from somewhere else, they were never seen as returning home. They were always seen as being from somewhere else.
Mm.
And those things have led to this view that there were no people left in Sydney, or anyone that was there was somehow also sort of pushed to the side and having to live in a way that was completely at the whim of colonial Sydney. Whereas, you know, when you look more closely at people, you see that they had, to a large extent, some control over their activities and their lives.
So a big part of your book is really making the case for the fact that all cultures are organic and that we can see Aboriginal people in Sydney negotiating change in a lot of different ways, but actually really successfully. I wonder if there's one or two stories from the book that you can share with us to illustrate that.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, one thing I'd say too is that that's something that I found quite a natural idea coming from archaeology, because I think archaeologists have not been great at explaining this to Australia. We've tended, the messages that most of Australians have kind of gleaned from archaeology is ancient, you know, the oldest Lake Mungo and, you know, the oldest dates of a site or something like that. But what the archaeological record shows us is an amazing record all over the continent of people dealing with change, whether it's climatic and, you know, change or technological change, interacting with other groups, trading, all of these things are an amazing record of people who've always lived with change.
Isn't there a fantastic example in your book of Aboriginal people using umbrellas, upside down umbrellas for fishing?
Yeah,
I thought that was a fantastic example.
Well, it is one of my favourite pieces of information. It's just a recollection from the 1930s of an elderly non-Aboriginal man who'd lived in the eastern suburbs and is recalling his childhood in the 1870s and seeing Aboriginal people spearfishing on the rocks at Rose Bay using their traditional multi-pronged fishing spear, but the prongs were swapped out for umbrella wires. And in more recent times, because community members still make them today, things like pram spokes have been used. I mean, that's just culture. That's continuity. That's not something ceasing. And in fact, it was an artifact, a tool exactly like that, that got me interested in this story. Back in 2000, I was doing some work actually at the what was then called the Centennial Bakery Museum. It's now the St. George Regional Museum. It was in an old bakery building, hence the name. And I was working on a NAIDOC Week exhibition. And in their collections, they had a bundi or a wooden club that was of sort of traditional style from Sydney, but it had horseshoe nails embedded in the head of the club. So it was absolutely a traditional artifact, but also quite clearly a hybrid as well. And that would have been interesting enough in itself, but at the same time, I met a senior Dharawal man from the La Perouse community, Dr. Shane Williams, whose family had lived nearby at a place called Salt Pan Creek. And that artifact, that club, came from that camp that was there until the 1930s. And these things are, they're not anomalies. They're just, we've just kind of cast them to one side because they don't fit the picture of the, you know, unchanged traditional way of life that we like to pretend is the only, you know, way of life when it comes to Aboriginal people.
Yeah, and maybe also some romantic suppositions in there that, you know, that are tied up with those notions of authenticity, that, you know, these objects have to be only using X, Y and Z materials,
yeah,
whereas in fact the real spirit of innovation that lies in all cultures being organic is in picking up new materials.
Absolutely,
and finding out ways to make
and we
work.
See that archaeologically with, you know, it might be new types of artifact that get made out of stone or shell or bone. But we also see it with language. I mean, language is another thing all peoples share, and language changes all the time, but it doesn't mean that it ceases to become our language. We just adapt it to new circumstances. So I think it really is something where if you start to see people's actions from that perspective, you also cease to see them as passive victims of colonial Sydney. And it's not by any means to suggest that Aboriginal people had an easy time of it. I mean, they were the traumatised survivors of invasion and disease epidemics and things, which makes their story all the more remarkable, that they not only held to their culture and connection, but found a way to negotiate a very rapidly changing and new environment and still stay in Sydney.
Tell us one or two stories. You know, one of my favourites is Cora Gooseberry's story and also Marut's. Mm. But you might have your own favourites.
Oh, look, yeah. Look, Marut is a fascinating individual. He was born in the 1790s, just after the smallpox epidemic hit Sydney. Mm. And his parents were from Botany Bay, and he grew up around Botany Bay. And as far as we can tell, he was a traditional owner of that area. But he, as a young man, lived with Europeans and went off on whaling and sealing ships, which quite a few Aboriginal men and I think some Aboriginal women did as well. But when he came back to Sydney as a, you know, probably in his 30s, he decided to settle down on the shores of Botany Bay on his traditional country and start a fishing business with his wife. Sadly, we don't know his wife's name, but we know that she was also from that area. And they built a hut for themselves on the shores of Botany Bay near Bunurong Creek, sort of right in the middle of where Port Botany is now.
I went looking for it one weekend and I couldn't find it. You said it was near the old hotel there, didn't you?
That's a different one. That's okay. Where he was actually buried. And and that's part of his story. You know, he started to this fishing business with his wife, but he also staked out 10 acres of land. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the really interesting things about Sydney too, is that when we say the word Sydney, we assume some kind of big city like we have now. Mm. And Sydney in the 19th century meant a very different thing. And the coastal part of Sydney is rocky and swampy and sandy. It's not particularly, for a very long time, wasn't particularly intensively used by Europeans. There certainly was people around, and the land was technically granted to or sold to people. But in the 1830s, Marut could mark out 10 acres of land, build a hut on it, and then go into the governor and say, I want that land. And he was given that land for the rest of his life.
So, because he was running fishing expeditions, wasn't he, and had a kind of business associated with a local hotel?
The hotel started up as a kind of pleasure ground hotel for people in Sydney.
It was a pretty big hotel, wasn't it?
Yeah, and that building is still there. And as far as we know, he was buried in an Aboriginal burial ground that was maintained in just next to the hotel for quite a few decades after his death. But he also rented out some other huts that he built on his land to white farmers and fishermen. So he was collecting a weekly rent. Mm. He appears on the City of Sydney or the Sydney Council's first assessment of landlords in the 1840s. So he was, you know, really someone who was harnessing his traditional connections, his traditional knowledge, but doing it in a way that allowed him to live as much as possible on his own terms. And I think that's a very common aspect. And Cora Gooseberry is another person who had those really deep connections, but was not afraid to interact to kind of, arguably Aboriginal people had to interact with the colony. That's not really the point. The point is how they chose to do that and the fact that they did have choice to some degree. You know, they were often living in places that they wanted to live. It's not to say all areas were open to them or anything like that. But I think if we cease to see people as victims that were forced to live somewhere or kind of... And that's quite tempting to do, because once we get to the 20th century across New South Wales, you know, we're in an era of segregation, of government enforced reserves and a real kind of prison system in some ways around New South Wales. So we imagine that that must stretch back to 1788. Mm. But it doesn't. You know, if we go back before that system was created, Aboriginal people in some cases, and Sydney is one of them, in coastal Sydney, had a greater capacity to shape their own lives, and that's really important.
Yeah, and there were quite close friendships between Indigenous and non-Indigenous people within the city of Sydney. You're listening to Glam City on 2SCR 107.3. To download this show, head to 2scr.com or your favourite podcast app and look for Glam City. This show is made by the Australian Centre for Public History at UTS with the support of 2SCR. And on this episode, we're talking to Paul Irish, a Sydney-based historian and archaeologist. And we're going to talk about the sources that you brought together to do this research on your fabulous book, Hidden in Plain View. So what'd you find? Where'd you find it? And what'd you do with it?
Well, it was I guess all historians would say that their archives are very fragmented and it takes a lot of hard work. And of course it does, whether you're telling a very small story or a big one. I guess I came to this got curious about the story of Aboriginal Sydney from Aboriginal colleagues and wanting to know more about the story of like how somewhere like La Perouse came to be, where it was and what it was. And I started reading a lot, and there's been, you know, I'm by no means the first person to research this. So there was a lot of local histories. You'll find quite often in a local council history or something, there'll be some reminiscence from an elderly resident in the 1950s or something saying, you know, back in when I was younger, there was an Aboriginal family living down the road. And the more of those I read, I started to think, well, are they, you know, did that really happen? Is it a bit of a misremembering? Is it what's going on there? And, you know, this coincided in the, around the mid-2000s with the digitising of a lot of historical sources, particularly newspapers. Mm. So where it previously might have taken you, you know, years to skim through all these newspapers, you could now keyword search. And what that did was just start to pull out tiny fragments of information, a newspaper article that might be about something completely different but mentioned that, you know, an Aboriginal person was living here, or, you know, old Jack was, you know, had a fishing boat or something like that. And you pull enough of those references together. And because of my archaeological background, my initial way into this story was to look at the places. So I was looking for references to the different places. So it was different places like Double Bay in the 1840s, for example, started to emerge in lots of different fragments of information. So you started to think, okay, so there was a camp there in the 1840s, and then you start to learn about some of the people that were there, and then you're kind of building up a bit of a biography of places and a bit of a biography of individual people, and enough of those start to then form a bit of a picture that allows you to trace out what's happening. But it was a very slow and organic process. You know, it went for many years before I started doing it as a PhD, and then more intensively while I was doing that. And, you know, even now, there's more information out there for sure. It's not like I found it all. What I was really hoping to do with the book was actually to try and draw together a bit of a framework so that people could understand the information that they do find. You know, Aboriginal people doing family history, local historians doing local histories are finding this information all the time, but it doesn't always make sense if you don't really know the context of, you know, if you found a reference in the 1850s, for example, to an Aboriginal person and a European having some sort of friendship or whatever, that wouldn't make sense unless you knew that context of how that came about.
So your book will become a sort of something that other people can keep adding to and building upon, we hope, you know, an opportunity to put a number of fragments together with the idea that more fragments are going to present themselves.
Yeah, and I hope that you know, whether or not that story holds or not is not, you know, the important thing, because there's so many fascinating individual stories in there that I think that's where, certainly where my own interest lies, but also where I think the strongest history is going to emerge is from looking in detail at particular people and understanding, sort of turning that big picture story inside out and looking how it was for maybe successive generations of one family to live through that, you know, big period of change.
You know, earlier I asked you some questions about some of the people in your book, but you have described yourself previously as a place-based historian, and it seems to me it would be really useful for our wonderful listeners if you could map out some of the key places that you did focus on in the book.
Well, the idea of Hidden in Plain View referred to people, it referred to places, and it referred to the archives. You know, in all of those cases, the people, the places, the sources have never not been there.
Mm.
But we've just not been seeing them for different
reasons. We weren't asking
that
question.
Yeah. And, you know, a really good example that I think, well, two examples. One is that sort of colonial landscape in the 19th century. You have dotted around Sydney some really revered historical buildings, places we call historic houses, somewhere like Vaucluse House or the Joseph Banks Hotel that we mentioned before down at Botany. These are places that are on heritage registers for the role that they played in, you know, community, social history, economic history, but they're not usually acknowledged as being places that Aboriginal people related to as well. And so I think it's quite interesting that we often are quite familiar with these places, we just don't realise they have an Aboriginal story. And Vaucluse House is sitting, you know, right on the shores of Vaucluse Bay. The original property covered the whole current-day suburb of Vaucluse. There are Aboriginal sites around there that date back thousands of years. There's a rock engraving out the back of the house. Aboriginal people worked there, lived there, camped there through to the 20th century. It's, you know, it's a place that's never really not been an Aboriginal place and still holds significance for people today. And that's a place that thousands of people visit every year. I like Vaucluse House too because it's still, if you go down into Neilson Park next to it, which is a national park and part of the original grounds of Vaucluse, the Vaucluse estate, you can get a sense of the bush that these places represent. That landscape persisted for 100 years before it was all subdivided and cleared, and that's really crucial to understanding that history.
Mm.
And the other place that's really crucial but invisible is a place that was called the Government Boat Shed down at Circular Quay. And it was a bit of a camp for Aboriginal people in the late 1870s, 1880s, who were living in some of these other places like Vaucluse, Rose Bay, Double Bay. And they came there when they wanted to sell and buy goods in the city. And it was an old abandoned repair shop for government boats. And the importance of it is partly where it is today. It's basically, there's nothing left of the building, but it sits in the forecourt of the Sydney Opera House. So it's right in the shadow of somewhere named after an Aboriginal person, Bennelong. But we pay so much more attention to someone like Bennelong than we do to events that happened 100 years later. And what happened there was arguably the trigger for the start of what was known as the Aborigines Protection Board in the 1880s, which went on in the early 20th century to enact policies of segregation, followed by assimilation, child removal, all of these things that we've heard and know about and which Aboriginal communities have been so impacted by. But that's ground zero for that event, and there is nothing there to show you that it ever existed.
And Stan's ancestor live there for a time.
Yeah, that's
too.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
So, Paul, you, in your discipline training, you started off as an archaeologist and then you've moved to incorporate history. But my husband's an archaeologist and I'm a historian and we see things pretty differently. So how do you reconcile these two different trainings, different foci? How do you reconcile it and how does it enrich, challenge your work?
I think it's not necessarily a case of finding a way to merge the two, but I guess you borrow things from one and apply it to another. I'd say the way that I came to history from viewing the landscape, for example, which is a very archaeological thing to do. It's not unique to archaeology, but you know all archaeologists are interested in places and how they fit within a landscape. And I just assumed that was how everyone saw the world and loved maps and you know liked finding out where things were and how far apart they were and how they related to each other. But it turns out not so much. But then there is also a very strong place-based history sort of movement in history as well of people who are focused on that, not necessarily coming from an archaeological background, but just are interested in places, how they evolve, the meaning of those places, and how the context of those changes over time. So I did find a body of work within archaeology, and in fact my supervisor at university, Maria Nugent, had worked on a lot of this sort of place-based history but also worked with archaeologists developing merging history and archaeology in quite creative ways as well. So it seemed quite natural to me.
Okay. So there weren't any particular tensions with, say, how you see an object, how you see a time period or anything like that?
I think partly because, I first came to this by doing a sort of archaeological study of what we'd call post-contact archaeology, the physical remains of Aboriginal life around Sydney, and I realised that there really wasn't a lot beyond the very early colonial years, and partly that was because we didn't really know what we were looking for, but also because we didn't really know where to look. So I realised that in order to go back to the archaeological, we had to get a better idea of where Aboriginal people were living, so we would have some sense of where to look and what we might be looking for. Okay. And I guess I've never really gone fully back into that sort of archaeological mode, because I got kind of captured by the lives of these people and the extraordinary, you know, lives that they lived. But I'm very much aware of locations as well. I'm not sure how much we will find in terms of archaeological traces of those lives, but I also think that the only way to do that is to just generate a better awareness of it. I mean, there are a lot of people like me who work as consultants, as archaeologists, doing assessments for building projects and things. If those people have got their eyes open and are aware that this archaeology may exist, does exist, then we'll have a chance of finding it. The problem is that for a long time we've assumed it didn't exist, so we weren't looking for it.
So what would you like, what do you think is the biggest gift that this book gave you?
I think it gave me a sense of where I live. I've been living, I grew up sort of in the northwest of Sydney, and I've been living the last 20 years or so, you know, close-ish to Botany Bay, on the western side of Botany Bay. And I've always felt a sort of affinity with the bay, or like it's always sort of had a pull.
Me too.
And I don't really know why, but I kind of like the history of that place as well as the environment. I'm kind of drawn to that. And I guess it's allowed me the privilege of learning not just about the Aboriginal history of Sydney, but just about Sydney more generally. I kind of feel like I know it in a way that I don't think I ever would have before. And I'm particularly pleased, and I wrote this in the start of the book as well, for my own children and for people that are going to come after us, to have some way of understanding an aspect of their city that they might not have had otherwise. There's tons of stories like this, Aboriginal and not, you know, in a city. And to be able to kind of bring that to people is pretty satisfying.
So it's kind of giving you a deeper sense of belonging.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Beautiful. It feels to me like a great place to wrap up and to say thank you so much for giving us a deeper sense of belonging as well. The book is fabulous, and I really encourage those of you who haven't yet read it to get it and read it as soon as possible. It really just made me feel so excited when I read it. So thank you again, Paul. Now we've come to this part of the show where we have a little game that we play, which is, what glam event are you going to do in the next fortnight? So what about you, Paul? What are you going to do?
Well, look, I'm looking forward to having a really good look at the Living Languages exhibition that's on at the moment at the State Library. I think it's on until May next year, and it's been up for a couple of months now, and we're in the International Year of Indigenous Languages, which is exciting, and I work with people who are working at La Perouse in that space as well, and who had a role in this exhibition. I've had a very quick look at it, but I'm looking forward to having a good look through it. It's featuring several communities from around and languages from around New South Wales, and I think is a real eye-opener probably for a lot of people about the role of language in Aboriginal people's lives today and the importance of that.
Brilliant. And I'm also going to go to an exhibition which is an ongoing one. This one opened in September and it's going to be open until March 2020, Glam City listeners, so you can get your hot little feet over there as well. It is called How the City Cares, and it's been based, initiated by the City of Sydney, and it's in Customs House in Alfred Street in Sydney. And it seems really cool. It's a whole group of sort of city-based artists looking at the fact that the city is not a place of modernist alienation, but actually a place where relationships form and people care for one another, just like we've been sort of looking at with Paul's work today. So I thought that was a nice little bit of continuity as well, to remember that cities are places where we live and love as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
This this does bring us to a close of Glam City for today. If you'd like to hear more from us, please head over to the 2SER website, which is 2SER.com, and you can also reach us on your favourite podcast app. This podcast is made by the Australian Centre for Public History with the support of 2SER 107.3. If you want to get in touch with us, you can email us on glamcity2ser.com. So if you've got some cool ideas for some other episodes, come on, let us know. Thanks, Paul. You were ace. And just a reminder, which I think is particularly relevant given today's conversation, that 2SER stands on the land of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and we acknowledge and we pay our respects, and we think about that ongoing contribution, the ongoing relationships for past, for present, for here now, and well into the future.